You'd be right if you guessed this is the music of Philip Glass. It's from an opera of his that's never been performed in Australia, but it's about to be. Hello, I'm Amanda Smith, and this is Artworks on ABC Radio National. Soon we'll meet the creative team behind this production of Satyagraha. Also today, the first Australian performance of a work by another big name in the contemporary American theatre. Tony Kushner is best known for his play Angels in America, also adapted for TV. Another play of his, set in England and Afghanistan, is about to get a run here, and I'll be speaking with Tony Kushner about it. Plus, in between, we'll run away to the circus. This week in Adelaide, Lee Warrenan dances, along with the State Opera of South Australia and the Adelaide Vocal Project, are combining forces to complete a project they started several years ago, to perform the three big Philip Glass operas known as the Portrait Trilogy. Each of these three operas focuses on an historical figure and their influence on the world. So far, they've done Einstein on the Beach, based around the life of the most famous scientist of the 20th century, and Akhenaten. He was the Egyptian pharaoh of some 3,000 years ago, who's said to have introduced monotheism to the world. The other work is Satyagraha, and it focuses on another great figure of the 20th century, Mahatma Gandhi, the father of India. This Australian production is directed and choreographed by Lee Warren, and the musical director is Timothy Sexton. It's set predominantly not in India, but in South Africa, where Gandhi lived from 1893 to 1914, and where he really started to put his beliefs into practice. As Lee Warren says, the ideology held in the word that's also the title of this opera, Satyagraha.
Well, the most direct usage is passive resistance. That's what we kind of identify. I think most people identify with the term. But it's quite a complex combination of words that mean truth, strength, love. There's a whole series of words that are connected to that. But, I mean, everyday usage, it really means passive resistance.
And this, of course, was Mohandas Gandhi's philosophy.
Yes, and it was the term was kind of coined actually in South Africa, and it went through a number of different stages to kind of finally arrive at its quite radical meaning. It's about really laying your life down without spilling somebody else's blood. You're willing to give up your own life, which is pretty out there.
In a way, they were very actively passive.
They were actively passive. Mm.
And Lee, what does reconceiving each of these three operas that you've done, the three Philip Glass operas, with a stronger choreographic component that you're bringing, what does it add to the works? I mean, you know, what have you as a dance person brought to these operas that adds value or meaning to them?
Well, I think when the text is in Sanskrit, you need sort of action can speak louder than words is a great help.
Yes, we should say, because the vocal lines in this are in Sanskrit. Yes.
And there are no, you know, surtitles or anything like that. So what often the movement does is help convey and amplify the actual feeling of each of the scenes. It adds a sort of counterpoint. But in this particular production, it's much more about the singers and the singing, because there's some glorious singing in this piece. I mean, it is quite lyrical in comparison to the more stringent and kind of aggressive rhythms of Einstein. But the actual the dance is always there in a kind of pyramid form to the singing and the kind of light and the design. That's the way I operate. It's always a fusion of forms.
How do you mean a pyramid form?
Well, they don't just... If you took one aspect of this away, it would be very lessened. It wouldn't work the same way. I mean,
it's a series of building blocks, I think, where each component, whether it be the music or the dance, is an integral part of a single picture.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And Tim, with the music, unlike Einstein on the Beach that was written for the Philip Glass Ensemble, Satyagraha is written for full orchestra. How have you gone about arranging it for this production for, I think, seven keyboards?
Seven keyboards and four players. That's right. The original opera is actually scored for 14 wind instruments, an organ, and a string section. So it doesn't have any brass and it doesn't have any percussion. What I've done is yes, rework all of that music down for essentially four keyboards that handle the winds, two keyboards that handle the organ parts, and a large keyboard that handles all of the string section. Because a lot of what Philip Glass writes is essentially a synthetic or a synthesized sound. I mean, what he demands of his live wind players and live string players is almost inhuman. It is just incessant and it's exhausting. And these figurations are actually much easier to play on keyboard. And given the sort of modern keyboards that we have, the sound is virtually indistinguishable from the real thing. And it just makes the whole coordination issue a little bit easier too, because you have four players to deal with, not 44.
And Lee, are you moving the singers in this work as well as your dancers?
Yes, they're involved in the movement a great deal. That's always been the case in each of the operas. And in a way, they're more involved in this than in any other.
And how have you found that as an experience of, as opposed to working with your own dancers, to getting singers to move?
I've found everybody very adaptable and very open to it. I think it's sort of allowed me to do all sorts of things that possibly would have taken me a lot longer to get to as just a choreographer. So,
how do you mean?
Well, it's the actual, when you work with a singer, it's like working with an actor. You have to really think about not just the physical shape and the musical dynamic. You really do have to give them all the psychological background. So you have to prepare them in a completely different way. So you have to always set the scene for them and to find different mechanisms for each performer that kind of brings them to a point where they can feel confident to take on a character or take on particular feelings, to so that that will come across and read as we wish it for the audience. So that's been a very different process for me. And just, you know, working with totally non-dancers and finding movement for them has really opened up my own vocabulary. So it's been a kind of win-win for me.
And Lee, what are the sort of choreographic challenges for your dancers in these projects? What's different for them about doing these Glass operas compared to other stuff with the company?
Well, there's an ensemble of seven, you know, when they're actually virtually on stage for an hour and a half, it's a marathon for their bodies as much as it is for the singers with their voices. But I think it's the different spaces. In Akhenaten, there were a series of tables that filled the space, and there's so many more props, and there's so many more people. And it's the integration of working with a different ensemble is always a bit tricky, because it's, you know, it's so easy when there's just seven little fish going around the bowl, you know, but suddenly when you've got 24, it's a whole different place there. But also this third set is a gigantic staircase, a bit like a sort of temple in chroma key blue, which is a ravishingly beautiful colour. And so there's not even an even surface. It's 90, each step is 90 centimetres wide, and it sort of continues to go up for seven levels. So
do wonders for the calves.
It does. and the coordination. I mean, they handle it remarkably, that you're almost not aware that they're on the staircase.
On ABC Radio National, this is Artworks. I'm Amanda Smith, talking about the first production to be seen in Australia of the Philip Glass opera Satyagraha. It's been performed this week in Adelaide. Lee Warren is the director and choreographer, and Tim Sexton is the musical director, and both of them are with us. Now, Tim, people tend to, with Philip Glass music, people tend to either love it or hate it. You know, you either find it meditative and hypnotic and profound, or I guess something like the oral equivalent of watching paint dry. To anyone who thinks the latter, what do you say?
Well, I think that's, there is a series of developments that happened in Philip Glass music, and Einstein being his first foray into this sort of operatic medium, it was really where he was trying out ideas. And Einstein as a production, as a piece of music, I think is very, you either love it or you hate it. It can be quite alienating. And or you can hate it but be fascinated by it. What occurred with Satyagraha, which was his sort of first commissioned opera and written for a traditional opera company, was a totally different process. And the music is much more traditionally operatic. It's actually a choral opera because there's so much choral singing in it. And there are beautiful ensembles, there are duets, there are solo voices heard as well. So I think people tend to think of, when they think of Philip Glass, they tend to think much more in the Einstein on the beach vein rather than in the vein of a lot of his later works, which are, in some cases, ravishingly beautiful. You only have to think of things like his violin concerto, a number of his later operatic works, because he's written about 16 or 17 of them, that this is glorious music where he's really, really refined those ideas and brought in much more romantic elements. And at the beginning of those romantic elements, we actually find in Satyagraha, because the music is beautiful, almost traditional choral singing, but just with these rhythmic elements that are very pertinent to Philip Glass. So it's, I think people need to not think about Philip Glass in terms of what he did initially in the 70s. They need to think about what he was actually doing in the 80s, which is a totally different ballpark entirely.
And Tim, with traditional operas, my experience, I guess, is that sometimes I feel like it's better just to listen to a recording of them than to see them in performance. I mean, I know there are people who are going to want to lynch me for saying that, but sometimes I think the performance actually kind of detracts from the music and the singing, the sound of it. I rather think that the reverse might be true, though, of these Philip Glass operas.
I guess what you're saying is that opera singers should be heard and not seen.
I guess I am actually. But also sometimes the production can seem very clunky too. I mean, sometimes it can be marvellous, yeah. But, you know, I'm just saying sometimes.
That's very true. I think that really depends upon the director and it depends upon the opera. We don't tend to find that with contemporary works. I think you find that sort of criticism could be much more readily levelled at more traditional works that are restaged. In the case of more contemporary works, I think that there is so much new territory to be explored and so many new ways in which they can be done that that's not really an issue.
Lee, does this trilogy of works, although they are operas, known as operas, do they lend themselves to dance in a particular way? In that I'm thinking about the subject matter even. I mean, they are supposedly portraits of great historical figures, but they're not really in any sense narratives or sort of biopics, are they? They are more about themes and concepts and ideas and rituals.
Well, that's very true of Einstein. That is exactly the picture you've painted, and that's what also makes it fascinating, because you can do almost anything with it, you know. But Gandhi really does have, it follows his evolution from a young lawyer through a number of events in his life to take him right through to that kind of final moment where he's out of reach of everyone, becomes an iconic figure in the kind of pantheon of the immortals. I mean,
this athlete of the spirit, as the translation of the text.
Exactly, and what a marathon athlete he was. Phenomenal.
Tim, now that you're approaching the completion of this portrait trilogy, what are your thoughts on the three people Philip Glass chose as the subjects for them? You know, of all the people in all the world through time, why Einstein, Gandhi and Akhenaten?
I think all three of them have a particular thing that really changed history in a fairly significant way. With Akhenaten, of course, this concept of monotheism was, and also it wasn't just monotheism that he brought about. There was an extraordinary change in Egyptian culture and art of that period. All of a sudden it became so much more expressive. It was after his death that it all reverted back to the sort of two-dimensional stuff that we're used to seeing in the hieroglyphs. But actually the art from the period is absolutely amazingly three-dimensional. It was an extraordinary time. And he really, I think, let people know within the Egyptian context that revolution was possible, that change was possible. Einstein really changed entirely our perception of the universe at a time at the beginning of the 20th century when science was undergoing an astonishing boom anyway, but he really brought a totally different view that has really, I think, informed most of our sort of scientific and astronomical views since then. It was an extraordinary turning point, and his totally different slant on science at that time was just amazing. It was a jolt that set the train going on a totally different track. And I think with Gandhi, it's just such an extraordinary boiling pot in the 20th century of cultures and clashes of cultures. And he stood as a very, very fixed post against which no current could resist or fight. And so he helped, I think, to very significantly change the nature of culture in the 20th century. So I think very, very pivotal, each in their own way.
And it's the, as you're saying, I guess it's the possibility of extraordinary change with each of them. Lee, for you, is there a thread that connects the three works?
I think Tim summed that up, you know, pretty well. I mean, my kind of approach is always to get to the core of each particular piece and dissecting and analysing the operas. But I mean, I'd hope there might have been, you know, a Madame Curie in there, or maybe he'll do another one and it'll be a woman next time. But it's interesting to have an opera where a man dies.
Well, that's most unusual for an opera, isn't it?
It is.
And he's not a soprano.
And he's not a soprano.
Although an Akhenaten. He was a countertenor.
I guess, as Tim says, each one of them has had profound influence and impact on us and continues to have.
And the production of Satyagraha, coming up in Adelaide, marks the completion of the cycle of Philip Glass operas known as the Portrait Trilogy for choreographer Lee Warren and musical director Timothy Sexton. Philip Glass, by the way, has just turned 70. How about that? Amanda Smith with you in Artworks on ABC Radio National. And we're off to the circus now. There were big tops, little tops, sword swallowers, trapeze artists, and gumboots aplenty at the Tasmanian Circus Festival last weekend. The Tasmanian Circus Festival is a biennial event, and this time round it was held at Lone Star, a property near Golconda in northern Tasmania. The purpose? To offer circus aficionados from all over Australia a chance to camp out, see a whole range of the country's best physical theatre shows in the one spot, and take in a few workshops as well. The festival has been running since 1989, and this year there was a special tribute to a pioneer of new circus in Australia, Reg Bolton, who died last year. He was the founder of Perth's Suitcase Circus. For Artworks, Belinda Bradley went along to some of the events and met some of the performers.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm the one and only Broadway Sue, the great, great, great maiden aunt of contemporary circus.
There's a fantastic freedom that comes with being that bit older, because when I was a trapeze artist and an acrobat and everything, I had that very self-conscious body image thing and had to be, you know, always concerned about my weight and wanting to present a really physical image of who I was. And I find now, with a bit more sense of my own ridiculousness, it's great fun to play with the body image stuff and to use that as a source for the comedy.
Good guess. How about this one? I go aged 18 and you all say, you haven't changed a bit. What do you reckon? Here we go. Sue Broadway, aged 18.
You haven't changed a bit.
I'm speaking with Sue Broadway, performing as Broadway Sue, a part of the Tasmanian Circus Festival. And Sue was one of the founders of Circus Oz and is currently just enjoying some time out and in a clown performance.
I've just come back from Qatar. I was the circus director for the opening and closing ceremonies of the Doha Asian Games. And I did all the circus stuff for the Sydney Olympics, and I programmed the circus material at the Cultural Festival in Melbourne for the Commonwealth Games last year. So that's my kind of big jobs. And then to get away from that work and to, you know, keep in touch with the fun side of life, I do little shows like this.
This festival, there's a tribute to Reg Bolton. Can you tell us something of what he contributed?
His attitude to circus was that it was, you know, the ideal art form for helping young people and children to develop into good human beings, basically. And he invented that idea, and he believed it so passionately that everyone he worked with was touched by that idea. And what he always said was that the thing about circus is that everyone can be good at something in it. If you can't be a good juggler, you can be a good stilt walker, and if you can't be a good stilt walker, you might be a good acrobat, and you know, you can always be a clown. So he really emphasised that effect of circus as a really inspiring experience for young people that brought them together and showed them about cooperating with each other, and that working together was always going to be better than fighting or, you know, trying to outdo each other, that cooperation was a great way to work. That set the tone for that kind of work all the way across the world, not just in Australia but around the world.
Ladies and gentlemen, they hosted the Circus Festival up in Mollumbimby 2001, and now they're here for your entertainment pleasure. Please put your hands together and welcome the Spaghetti Circus.
Simon Adams is the Artistic Director of Spaghetti Circus. How long has the circus been around?
Well, we're a youth circus. We started 15 years ago. Started from a disadvantaged schools program up in Mullumbimby, and now we've got over 350 children that come and attend classes. So, as you can imagine, it's a huge part of the community and feeds into the community in so many ways.
And how do you see kids change from doing circus?
Well, their self-confidence just goes through the roof. We had a few kids who were doing this production who just joined us a couple of years ago, you know, as sort of shy teenagers, and now they're just going through the roof. They feel so confident, and I guess that physical strength allows them a sort of a self-worth as well as that self-discipline.
We have regular coaches and, you know, trainers come in, but we go see, like, you know, we went to saw Cirque du Soleil, and that really, you know, inspires you as well. And just coming here and seeing everyone do their thing, you know, makes you want to be like them.
Stay at school!
Are you having fun at the festival?
Yes.
Would you like to join the circus?
Yes.
And if you joined, what would you be?
A clown.
I'm speaking with Claire Bartholomew, who won the 2002 Foreign Exchange Award. And then Claire performed with a group called The Business, an all-female clown ensemble, who won the British Council Oz Export Award in 2003. So your speciality is clown?
I guess so. I mean, when I perform in theatres, I don't ever wear a red nose, but I teach clown and I've used clown a lot. So I use the skills of clowning for my performing. So often I describe it as physical comedy or slapstick or character-based physical comedy.
And what do you think people get from clowning?
Hopefully there's a lot of laughter. But I think also it makes people reflect on their own humanity. I just saw a show just then by Circus Risque, and there's beautiful clowning in that with a young guy, Kane, who's constantly in love with the leading lady of the show, and he never gets her. And everyone has had those feelings. He does a beautiful slow exit where he keeps coming back to the audience, and we're all calling out how much we love him and we want him to stay. And I think, you know, clowns always want to succeed. They want to be the star of the show, and they never usually are. They're always sort of sidelined and trying to wheedle their way in, you know, under the curtain or whatever. But it resonates with people when they see it.
And you've created a character for the festival?
She's called Petrushka, and she was going to be Russian, but my accent was terrible, so she's staying with being German. And she's very high status, and she's sort of come in here. She's being flown in every day from Launceston in a chopper, and she's very distressed about the toilet situation.
Have you ever thought about joining the circus?
Well, I have a New Year's resolution to learn juggling.
Why did you make that as opposed to hula hooping?
I like it how you can just do it with anything on hand. You can just pick up any household object and start juggling with it. And
okay.
Yeah.
You could be juggling knives by the end of the year.
You can juggle anywhere, you know.
At the moment, I'm watching Judith Lanigan, alias Miss Judy, who's in a short purple skirt with purple sparkly high heels and is managing at the same time to do a hula hoop routine. Miss Judy's about to put herself through a tiny hula hoop, smallest I've ever seen. She's got one arm through, and now she's trying to get the other arm through, and yes, she's managed to get it over her shoulders. Yes, she's got it all over her body. It's a very tiny hoop, you'd be amazed. She's got it all the way through.
Is hula hoop, is that what you mainly do?
That's my speciality. Yeah, it's my main skill. And circus has always traditionally taken normal, everyday, domestic objects or means of transportation, like the bicycle or the horse, and taking them to extremes. So they're things that everyone recognises. And then also, no matter what, especially if you work with clown, where you're not language-based, everyone understands all over the world, because I work in so many different countries. I mean, I happen to have a little bit of a knack for languages, so I can do my show in French, English, Spanish, German, Italian and Japanese. But I also know that if I didn't, I could still communicate with any audience physically. And so quite often in story in circus is just about taking a few characters, and then story is about what happens when those characters interact on stage for different reasons. Unless you're working with a theme that's been given to you. For example, at the moment I'm working on a show in Newcastle for an organisation called Newcastle Live Sites. We're doing a historical circus dinner cabaret show where we're taking stories from the history of Newcastle and weaving them through into an entertainment.
And do you think Australian audiences appreciate circus and physical theatre?
More and more. It's just starting to... You can see it building as they get exposed to, you know, the work that Circus Oz does, or Circus Monoxide, or the street theatre artists that you see around the place. We haven't had a very big culture of it. So, for instance, I was working at a festival in France, a very small festival, and all the artists sit around on the, you know, outside eating dinner at midnight, which is what happens over there. And someone asked me, what's circus like in Australia? And I was saying, well, if you got all of the artists, at that time, that was 5 years ago, if you got all of the artists, professional circus artists in Australia together, it would look like this, the artists working at this very small French. Now, it's got a lot bigger now. It's growing more and more all the time.
To Broadway. What do you think are the major changes in circus in the time that you've been involved in it?
I think that the first obvious one is just the skill level. I mean, when we started Circus Oz, we were making it up as we went along, really. And we found people to teach us stuff, and we saw things on TV and tried them until we could do them. And, you know, it was a very hit-and-miss kind of procedure. I actually did start my career in traditional circus. I did 6 months on the road with Soul Brothers Circus, so I learnt some basic aerial stuff through them. But after that, we were pretty much on our own, you know, just getting in occasional guest teachers. And what you see now is this fantastic skill level that's developing across the community, and partly that comes from the improvement in the schools. You know, Fruit Fly is turning out very high level students now, and Nika, of course, has completely changed the physical skill level. But also it's to do with people building on what they've seen. You know, the kids who are starting to get into circus now, they've already seen all of these acts by the time they even start training, so they don't have any idea that you can't do things. They have an idea that all of that's possible, and they're just going to go for it and do it. And so you see a fantastic increase in all of that energy and skill level. It's great.
And for artworks, Belinda Bradley was at the Tasmanian Circus Festival last weekend. She was speaking with Sue Broadway, Simon Adams, Claire Bartholomew and Judith Lanigan, with special thanks to Tony Rourke from the festival. This is Artworks on ABC Radio National. Now, Tony Kushner is a big name of the American contemporary theatre. His epic play Angels in America has won a Pulitzer Prize, 2 Tony Awards, plus heaps of other awards. Then there was the television version of it with Al Pacino and Meryl Streep and Emma Thompson. It was screened in Australia in 2004. Another play of his, called Homebody Carbel, is about to be performed in Australia for the first time. It's a play that starts with a long monologue delivered by a housewife, the homebody, sitting in her kitchen in London. After she disappears, apparently to Afghanistan, the action of the play shifts to Carbel, where her husband and daughter are searching for her, or her body, terrified and bewildered in this city under the Taliban. Tony Kushner started writing Homebody Carble in 1997. And since its first performance in New York in December 2001, the word most often applied to it is prescient. On the phone from his home in New York, Tony Kushner says his interest in Afghanistan was sparked by the Soviet invasion in 1979 and its consequences, and the country's long, terrible history of invasion and civil war.
I've been interested in Afghanistan since my college days, because the history of Afghanistan is really the history of the world. I mean, every empire of any significance has gone through Afghanistan or tried to conquer it, and all sorts of major players in the world historical stage have made an appearance in Afghanistan. It's an extraordinary place. So I thought that it was time to write about America and the West and its relationship to the rest of the world. And Afghanistan seemed to be the appropriate place to turn. I went to the library one day. There wasn't very much written about Afghanistan that I could find in 1997 that was current. So I went to New York University Library and took out every book I could find on Afghanistan, which is about 10 books. I would imagine now it's several thousand, but at the time there were only about 10 that I could find, and one of them happened to be an out-of-date guidebook to the city of Kabul.
Which makes its way into this play, of course, in
which
that...
Which was the basis of the character, really.
The Homebody quotes from this old guidebook. Now, you set this play in 1998-1999, but it wasn't first performed until December 2001 in New York. Now, I'm sure you're sick, heartily sick of the term eerily prescient, Tony, being applied to this play, but what was the reaction to it when it was first performed in New York, December 2001?
When the theater, New York Theater Workshop, announced that they were doing the play, I did a number of interviews. This was in July of 2001, and every interview that I gave, the first question was, why on earth are you writing about Afghanistan, and why would that be of interest to anyone? I had a whole sort of spiel prepared as an answer to that. That obviously wasn't a question I was asked after the play opened. And the first reaction, which happened before the play opened, right after 9/11, was a question from a number of reporters, you know, are you going to cancel the play? Don't you think you should cancel it? Is it appropriate to do, you know, the play is about Afghanistan and to some degree about terrorism. I mean, is it appropriate to do this play now? Shouldn't all theaters sort of go away until, you know, we've sorted all this out? Which, of course, was never an option that we considered for a minute. I mean, getting over the emotional devastation of what happened on 9/11 and the grief and the fear that accompanied this attack on my home, I began to, you know, go through the play in my mind and to think about what I had done and how it would play and what use it had, if it had any use, in the world after 9/11. And I decided that, you know, I had done my homework. I had researched the topic in writing the play for 3 years, and the play seemed to me to be of the moment, obviously, but also useful in the moment, because it is very much a play about grief and mourning and death and an encounter, both violent and non-violent encounters with the other, with the unknown, with another country, another culture. And it seemed to me to address all sorts of things that New York City and in some sense the country and the world were having to address in a new way after 9/11 in a way that was useful. I mean, starting with the fact that when you walk in the theater, you're rather than being greeted by, you know, a play about 9/11, about planes crashing into skyscrapers, you're greeted by a British housewife sitting in her kitchen reading to you from this outdated guidebook about a city that, you know, ceased to exist. And I mean, the response was, you know, all over the place. There were people who really loved it. There were people who said, well, it's not a very good play. Some people criticized it. I think the Wall Street Journal said this is a play that could have been written by a Taliban foot soldier. Which, you know, was sort of amusing.
Yes, I think the word sordid was used in that review, wasn't it? It was so sordid.
Probably, yes.
Yeah.
The criticism came from all over the place, and that's what you want, really, with anything, I would think, is that you delight some people and appall other people. If any play that I wrote ever got universal acclaim, I'd start to get worried.
I'm interested in this play, with your four British characters,
they are all in some way, it occurred to me after I'd read the script the first time, they're all in some way drugged. We hear that the homebody and her husband are on antidepressants. We find out later that the daughter took pills in a suicide attempt. And then there's another character, a British aid worker in Kabul, who turns out to be a heroin addict in a country that's the world centre of opium production. Right. Why have you tranquilised all the Westerners in this play?
You know, I can't really explain that. I mean, I think it's a completely legitimate observation. I mean, there's no allegory. There's no attempt to sort of suggest that, you know, the West is asleep or the West is, you know, drugged or addicted to, you know, various kinds of narcotizing chemicals or opiates. But, you know, on the other hand, if somebody wanted to argue that that was something that was going on in the play, I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that. I don't write with any kind of schema in mind, and when someone discovers a connection like the one that you've just mentioned, I'm delighted, but I don't know that I particularly want to, you know, put a neon sign around it for people who are going to see the play. Yeah. I mean, it's a very large play, and I think it's a mysterious play. I don't think it would be very difficult to say specifically, well, it means this or it means that. I mean, there are certain things that are deplored in the play. There's a certain, you know, level of human suffering and misapprehension between cultures that's scrutinized. I certainly didn't try to make a simple didactic play or a docudrama. I hope that it's bigger and more disturbing and mysterious than that.
Well, certainly you are regarded as a writer who deals in epic. You mention this as a large and mysterious play. You've also, I think, written in the past, a good play, like a good lasagna, should be overstuffed. Can you tease out that idea as your theatrical aesthetic ambition?
Well, it's not really an ambition. I mean, it may be a failing. Now, someone was just quoting me Voltaire saying, I'm sorry, writing at the end of a very long letter, I apologize for having written you this terribly long letter. I didn't have time to write a short one. I mean, that, you know, I think that there's something to be said in the notion that boiling things down to sort of a Samuel Beckett-sized play is a noble and impressive accomplishment, but it's simply not something that I'm given to temperamentally. I tend to sort of expand and digress. The way that Brecht described it is the best. It's sort of the difference between, let's say, one-point perspective in Renaissance European art and, let's say, Japanese landscape painting, where the eye is not directed to any particular place. Or, in to use a Western example, the paintings of Bruegel, which was an example that Brecht used, that where the
eye
goes
is really
all not
over
told
the place.
Where to fall. Mm. And, you know, there's a sense that you, I mean, my favorite novel, my favorite work of American literature, at least, is Moby Dick. And, you know, I mean, again, it's so vast and so unapologetic in its ambition to encompass the entire planet that it barely coheres, in a certain sense, as a work of art. And yet very, very deep within it, there are powerful themes and threads that hold the whole thing together. And it's a book that one can turn at different angles and see completely different things at all times. And as one changes and ages and as the world changes around one, you approach a book like Moby Dick or, let's say, a play like Faust very differently every time you look at it. And that may be true of all great works of art. I mean, I think that may be true of, you know, Not I, or one of the really, really tiny but very, very profound Beckett plays. But I think that, you know, vastness and size and the overreach, a sort of an overstuffed quality, are legitimate aesthetic gestures. And I disagree with the notion that there's something inherently superior or preferable in boiling ambition down and boiling language down. I think that I happen to be someone who likes, you know, great helpings of language and plot and event. I like the theatricality of it.
Well, there is definitely a kind of relish about language in your work, for sure. Is this, Tony, is this a good time to be a playwright, do you reckon, to be writing the kind of plays you want to write?
All times are good times for playwrights, and, you know, I don't think the theatre is really any different from any other art form in that regard, but it's certainly, I think that any time that there's great civic unrest and discontent and confusion, and the road ahead is particularly unclear, people turn to art and frequently will turn to theater as a place to go and sort of watch the issues of the day embodied in the bodies of actors. theater is, it's fast. It responds quickly or relatively quickly to the immediate moment. And of course, it's live, so it happens in front of you. It can change in front of you. You change it by your responses to it. And I think that in dangerous times, there's an increased appetite for gathering in large rooms with a lot of different people and watching a live event like this. Unsettled times like these are great times to be a theater artist.
Tony Kushner, speaking from New York. And this is Artworks, Amanda Smith with you on ABC Radio National. Tony Kushner's play Homebody Carble has its first production in Australia, opening next Saturday. Theatre at Risk is the company doing it, and the artistic director of Theatre at Risk and director of this play is Chris Bendel. So why put Homebody Carble on in Australia at this time?
I think in terms of the subject matter, what Kushner's doing with this play is really trying to find an understanding and a new way of looking at Afghanistan and, in fact, the Middle East and the sort of the East-West divide. And I think, well, without question, it's been a really important issue as far as Australians lately about that kind of cultural collision that's happening at the moment between our kind of understanding of the Middle East and our understanding of Islam. And what this play tries to do is try to find some kind of common ground and some kind of sense of communication and some connecting point between East and West.
It has an unusual structure, this play, and with the productions of it to date in America and Britain, the reviews have often raved about the first act, the big monologue, but been less enthusiastic about the rest of the play, the act set in Kabul. Is it difficult to make this play work structurally?
It was written initially as the opening monologue, and then the second part followed Kabul. So it was the sort of one play, Homebody, played several times for a period of 2 years or so before Kabul was then developed and it became the full-length play. And they are quite different stylistically as well. The Kabul story, which is all set in Afghanistan or primarily, is much more naturalistic in a way. It follows a sort of almost a filmic thriller type structure in a way. Thriller's a bit of an exaggeration, but it's a simple idea. They're searching for the mother and there's quite a clear structure. Whereas the opening monologue is extremely original in its form, 50 minutes of deliriously witty language. So yes, to try and put the two together is a challenge.
Reading the script, obviously I haven't seen it yet, Chris. In part, it's actually very funny off the page. Anyway, is it funny in performance?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I'm finding it so. And I think that's the other thing that's beautiful about it. And I'm glad you mentioned it, actually, because it would sound that it would be a very intense and perhaps highly strung sort of evening given the subject matter. But what Kushner finds, and for those that know Angels in America, he has a lovely kind of absurdly comic touch and beautifully drawn characters. And it's partly through the characters, I think, that the humour comes out. We sort of love the characters and their idiosyncrasies and their oddities. And I think the performers really bring out the humour of this work. The Homebody particularly, apart from being wildly intelligent and feverishly exciting sort of monologue, it's very funny as well. Her plays with language, her idiosyncrasies. He treads a very beautiful balance in the writing between the kind of absurdly comic and the serious and the tragic.
At Theatre at Risk, your company, you've given a theme to the 2007 season of faith, hope and charity.
Yes.
Why that theme and how does this play fit into that theme?
We started thinking about theming our years last year, and we took the idea of looking back at the 20th century and reflecting on history's influence on today last year. And that seemed to be a really interesting way to kind of hang a year. There's so much work out there that we could choose from, so it seemed like putting a limiting structure on myself as a curator was a good idea. I guess for the reasons that I was explaining about the choice of the play before, Faith, Hope and Charity seemed to be important. Partly I'd read in all my readings of work from here and abroad, read a lot of plays that are quite depressing and sort of the state of the world is quite depressing at the moment. But I was very eager to find some work that would actually provide some kind of hope and some sort of possibility for answers. Not that a theatre should provide answers, but to at least raise questions and provoke people to think about what those answers could be, about how we can live in the world and how we can deal with, you know, the world's traumas, blah, blah, blah. So hope was important to me. And then these recurring issue of faith seemed to be sort of really interesting, how to deal with you know, opposing faiths and the sort of cultural collisions, as I was saying before, that seems to really be the kind of hot issue that I think needs to be tackled in a way. And theatre is a great medium to do so. So then the theme of faith, hope and charity seemed to occur to me. The charity sort of perhaps tacked on at the end a little bit.
Well, perhaps that's what your patrons will do for your company.
Perhaps that's what that part is about, yeah.
Well, Chris, I'm intrigued to see this play now too, Homebody Kabul. It opens in Melbourne next Saturday night. Chris Bendel is the director. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to you for having me. I'm Amanda Smith. Artworks is produced by Deborah McCoy, along with Suzanne Donisthorpe. Technical producer is Russell Thompson. It's also broadcast on Tuesday afternoons after 3 o'clock. And it's available as a podcast. The details on how to download it to your MP3 player are on the website, abc.net.au/rn. After the news now on ABC Radio National, Julie Copeland with Exhibit A. Today, remembering the Italian composer Giancarlo Menotti, who died recently. 50 years ago, he founded the Spoleto Festival in Umbria, and he also created a version of it in Australia, what's now the Melbourne International Arts Festival. And following Exhibit A, it's movie time with Julie Rigg. That's all in the next hour on ABC Radio National.